Someone said, are we done? I'll try to make it quick, but we're not quite done. It's good to be here. It always amazes me how stuff connects. We spent some time discussing whether we should, or that they gave instructions to the Gentiles not to eat meat polluted by idols. And the title of my message this morning is the story part 34, How to Make an Idol Jump. I was trying to go for something clickbaity, and I don't know if that quite qualifies or not, but how to make an idol jump. So we're in the middle of a big series called The Story, looking at the characters and themes and I guess individual stories in the Old Testament right now, and how it all points forward to the coming of Jesus. And right now we're in the book of Samuel, and this could kind of be its own, I guess, mini-series, because there's so many cool things in Samuel that you could really dive deep into. And this is actually the third in the series of Samuel, and we're only to chapter 5. I'd like to spend quite a bit of time in Samuel because of just how much deep stuff there is there. So the first time we looked at kind of the main themes of the whole book, and Trenton, if you can put up the slide there, these are kind of the three main themes, I think, that are in the book of Samuel. First one being God opposes the proud and exalts the humble. Number two, despite human evil, God is still at work. And then three, God will eventually raise up a messianic king. So last time, that was our first look at Samuel. Last time, which was our second time in Samuel, we looked at chapters 4 and 5, which gave us kind of a backdrop for the whole book. And it tells us about Eli and his evil sons, Hophni and Phinehas, and how, I guess that was actually the last part of chapter 2 and then chapter 3. Chapter 3 is where God calls Samuel and shows that he is going to be the next, prophet for Israel, which is kind of the backdrop for the whole book, because Samuel's involved in pretty much everything going forward then. And then the last part that we looked at there was chapter 4, and that's the story of where the Philistines are at war with the Israelites, and first day that they go to war, the Israelites lose 4,000 soldiers. 4,000 men are killed. And so they go back to their camp and they're like, what are we going to do here? We're just about to lose this whole thing. Let's go get the ark and take it with us out to battle. And then God will have to move and we'll be saved. So they grab the ark and trot it out to the next day at their battle, and it doesn't go so well. They end up losing 30,000 men, and what started out as the Philistines being afraid, it says that they're like, nothing like this has ever happened. We know that this God is powerful because of what he did with the Egyptians and all that stuff, but instead of actually being afraid and like running away, they say, well, let's take courage because we don't want to be slaves to these people, and it just ends up making them more courageous, I guess, and they have a huge victory. So by the end of chapter 4, we're left with a whole bunch of dead Israelites. The ark is gone because the Philistines capture it and take it with them. And because the ark is gone, that would mean that the presence of God is gone, which is the only thing that separates Israel from destruction. I mean, it's the only thing that has saved them this far and kept them where they are. Well, now that is even gone. So what's the hope that there's even a future for them or that the story will even continue? And I'm sure that's what they were thinking. So we pick up there in chapter 5. I'm going to read verses 1 through 5 of 1 Samuel chapter 5. And that'll give us, well, then we'll look at some background of what we're going to be reading there. So starting in verse 5, it says, when the Philistines captured the Ark of God, they brought it from Ebenezer to Ashdod. Then the Philistines took the Ark of God and brought it into the house of Dagon and set it up beside Dagon. And when the people of Ashdod rose early the next day, behold, Dagon had fallen face downward on the ground before the Ark of the Lord. So they took Dagon and put him back in his place. But when they rose early on the next morning, behold, Dagon had fallen face downward on the ground before the Lord, and the head of Dagon and both his hands were lying cut off on the threshold. Only the trunk of Dagon was left to him. This is why the priests of Dagon and all who enter the house of Dagon do not tread on the threshold of Dagon in Ashdod to this day. And I know I've said this before, but you can't make this stuff up. It's too crazy to be just a story that someone thought up and wrote. And if you think the Bible is boring, you either don't believe it's true or you don't understand what you're reading, because there's so much stuff there. Anyway, a little bit of context. I have a map, trying to see if you can put that up. It kind of helps us visualize this a little bit. So Shiloh was where the tabernacle was, where the ark originally was, and where Eli and his sons were supposed to be serving. So that's number one there. Aphek was up in the left corner there, is where the Israelite camp was, and then Ebenezer was actually the location of the battle itself. And Ebenezer is where they took the ark for the battle. So that's where the ark is captured. And then this is what I found interesting is the Philistines take it all the way down to Ashdod, and we don't have a scale here to show you how far this is, but if you know kind of where we're at in Israel, that's a pretty good long ways. I mean, we're talking, I think it was around 60 miles or so. I should have dug into that for sure, but so it was a good little distance that they took it. It wasn't just the closest place where they could quick set it up and have a party because they captured it. This was taken to a specific city for a specific reason. It's not like that was the only city that they could have taken it to. So we'll look at why that is. So Ashdod was a seaside city, you can see there on the Mediterranean, and it was kind of a port for a lot of fishing. And this god Dagon was actually part man, part fish. I wanted to get a picture, but I couldn't actually find any good ones that you didn't have to pay for, like drawings of it or whatever. But it's basically a man, how it's depicted is a man on top with a fish bottom, kind of like I guess you could call it a merman. Instead of a mermaid, it would be a merman, is what this god looked like. And I didn't realize this, but Dagon was a big deal. I mean, it was actually considered the father of Baal. And I always thought that Baal was like one of the greatest, whatever, gods of the Philistines. But Dagon was actually considered his dad. And I think you could make the argument that he was the greatest of the gods for the Philistines. And the other thing that I found interesting is Ashdod there, where they took the ark, was not the only temple for Dagon. There were multiple of these very large temples specifically built for Dagon. How many of you remember the first time that Dagon is ever mentioned in the Bible? Can you think of another time where the god Dagon is mentioned? A little rusty on your Philistine gods. It's fine, I didn't know it either. I would have completely forgotten this. I'm going to read the account. It's actually in Judges, and we completely skipped over this. This would have been obviously before Samuel, but we completely skipped over this. It's Judges 16, 23 through 30. It says, "Now the lords of the Philistines gathered to offer a great sacrifice to Dagon, their god, and to rejoice. They said, 'Our God has given Samson, our enemy, into our hand.' And when the people saw him, they praised their god. For they said, 'Our God has given our enemy into our hand, the ravager of our country who has killed many of us.' And when their hearts were merry, they said, 'Call Samson that he may entertain us.' So they called Samson out of the prison, and he entertained them. They made him stand between the pillars. And Samson said to the young man who held him by the hand, 'Let me feel the pillars in which the house rests, that I may lean against them.' Now the house was full of men and women. All the lords of the Philistines were there, and on the roof there were about 3,000. And on the roof there were about 3,000 men and women who looked on while Samson entertained. Then Samson called to the Lord and said, "O Lord God, please remember me and please strengthen me this once. O God, that I may be avenged on the Philistines for my two eyes." And Samson grasped the two middle pillars on which the house rested, and he leaned his weight against them, his right hand on the one and his left hand on the other. And Samson said, "Let me die with the Philistines." Then he bowed with all his strength, and the house fell upon the lords and upon all the people who were in it. So the dead whom he killed at his death were more than those he had killed during his life. Notice how the Philistines, they actually brought Samson out, and they were having a party to honor Dagon for letting, or for giving them the power, I guess, to conquer him or capture him. And that gives us a kind of a clue on how they thought. And I never made this connection before, but I think maybe the closest we could understand it to is maybe similar to how like an Islamic jihadist would fight for Allah. It wasn't just like this was a god that they set up and then they kind of worship him and hope that he gives them, you know, good crops or whatever. They specifically did things to bring him honor, or that's what they thought they were doing. There was a very religious, I guess, overtone to what they did, even the wars that they fought that I never had caught before. So the stuff that they were doing was specifically done to bring honor and glory to this god Dagon. And that kind of changes how you look at this account, and this account here with Samson as well as the one with the Philistines. Because doing something great like capturing the ark or capturing their greatest enemy with Samson, it reaffirmed what they thought about their God, and that was that he was the greatest. And then going and giving that thing to that God was kind of lifting themselves up in the eyes of that God. So keep that in mind as we look at why they're doing what they're doing. And it's also why, you know, Samson knocking down Dagon's temple meant a lot more than just the physical act of knocking down a temple. It meant that maybe Dagon wasn't quite as powerful as they thought. If he couldn't even protect his own house, this God that, you know, had done all this stuff with the Egyptians, even though it looked like now he wasn't as powerful as he used to be, suddenly he's now back up and even more powerful than Dagon. So that meant something. And we'll see that even more in the story here in Samuel. So when the Philistines capture the ark and they win this huge battle, this was the ultimate victory for Dagon, because now the Israelites didn't even have their God anymore, is how they would have looked at it. So they were done in the Philistines' eyes. If the Philistines could just walk up and take the thing that represented the presence of this God, they could just take it with them. That meant that they had the ultimate victory over these enemies of theirs. And ultimately, it meant that Dagon was more powerful than this God, even though there had been some amazing things that happened in the past. Apparently, he was either, you know, had deserted the Israelites, or he was on vacation or something. He wasn't working anymore. So that put God underneath Dagon again, where the Philistines wanted him. I think it's really important to understand that when you look at this story and why this is such an important one. So when they take it down to Ashdod, the ark that is, that's a long way to kind of haul, I guess, a big heavy box. And I don't know exactly how large this temple of Dagon was, but considering the size of the city, I'm guessing it was actually one of the largest ones. And that's probably why they took it there. In the past, I'd kind of always envisioned the place where they took the ark and set it up as maybe just kind of a small hut. I think the reason I thought that was because after the second night, Dagon falls off again, And his, it says his hands and his head, well, I always thought of it as like fell off or broke off, and were lying on the threshold. Well, that would mean that it had to be fairly close to the door. And I always thought of that as why it would have to be a pretty small place for that to happen. Because obviously, unless it's a huge idol, if it falls over and it lands on the threshold, it's got to be fairly close to where the idol is. However, after digging into this a little bit more and realizing that this is probably a huge temple, if the one over in Gaza, where the whole account with Samson happened, could fit 3,000 people inside, I'm guessing this was at least a similar size or maybe even bigger. This was a big thing. And we'll look at that a little bit more when we get to that part of it, but just a preview, I don't think his hands and head were just broken off. In fact, there's another word used there. We'll look at that. So to sum it up, this is a tremendously big deal for the Philistines and the Israelites. Philistines had proven once and for all that Dagon was the greatest, and the God of the Israelites was either dead or no longer present. He was choosing not to be present. And for the Israelites, it meant that they were doomed to be slaves to the Philistines with no hope of deliverance because their God could no longer step in and save them. He wasn't even with them anymore. But if you think about those two themes, how the Philistines were thinking and how the Israelites were thinking, it brings us back to those two points, the first two points in the main themes of Samuel, that being God opposes the proud and exalts the humble, and despite human evil, God is still at work. Again, those points come out really clear in this story. There's a technique that story writers use called character development to get you invested in the main characters. I don't know if you've ever thought about that, but they'll write in a whole bunch of seemingly small details or little accounts, I guess, toward the beginning of a story that get you to want to like the main character. Usually that's the case. I mean, sometimes there's exceptions, but they want you to get invested in the main character, the good guy, and care about what happens to him. And then at the same time, there's also often details put in about the bad guy that makes you really not like him and want to see him taken down. And a good story writer can do that very quickly at the beginning so that you're invested the whole way through the story. It's why you're fine with reading a 500-page novel or maybe watching a 2.5-hour movie and keeping your attention the whole way through. One example of this was the 1994 movie The Lion King. I had never actually seen it. I knew it was kind of considered a classic and whatever, but I'd never actually seen it until this winter. And you know, it's supposed to be a kid's movie. It's not meant to be like an epic story necessarily. But from like within a few minutes, I was very invested in the story. And if you ever get a chance, part of it is the themes of the whole movie are redemption. And so there's something deeper going on there that is pointing toward. But it's really good at character development. Anyway, all that to say, most of the time, Bible stories don't do that. There's not the details in there to make you become invested in the characters. It's just, here's the facts, here's what happened, moving on. And so when there are details that are seemingly insignificant in our minds, there's a reason they're there. And I think often we just jump over it and we're like, well, whatever, that was just thrown in to make it more interesting, when that's not really how the Bible was written. It wasn't, most of the time the details that are in there are not there to just make it more interesting for us. They're there for a very specific reason to make a very specific point. And I just encourage you to, as you're reading the Bible, to consider that. Something that seems insignificant, if it's there, there's usually a very pointed reason that it's there. And sometimes it's very clear, but then other times, because we're not in that context, it doesn't quite make sense why that's, like, why is it important enough to put that in there? Until you dig in a little bit deeper, usually you can find it. Anyway, there's a number of those kind of details in this story, and I want to look at just a few of them. You could take almost any of these things and go down a rabbit hole and dig and find all kinds of pretty crazy things that God was doing and why he chose to do it that way to make the point. So we're going to look at a few of them, but we don't have time to look at all of them. Anyway, the first one that jumped out to me is that the what happens there after the ark is placed in the temple. So the ark is set down as kind of a trophy to Dagon, apparently beside him or in front of him, and everyone goes home for a good night's sleep, and they're probably all, you know, happy and partying, and they come back the next morning, and where is Dagon? Well, verse 3 says that he had fallen face down on the ground before the ark of the Lord. Now, over and over in the Old Testament and the New, people would come before God to worship him, and how would they come before him? It often mentions it how somebody comes before God or came before God. Yeah, they would fall down on their face before the Lord. Moses did it. I think it even mentions Abraham a couple times. There's a reason that this idol fell down face, and why it specifically says that it fell face down before the ark. And I think the people that saw that would have immediately recognized what was happening. This wasn't just an accident that the thing fell over, and however it landed. I don't know where the ark was in relation to the idol, but it's interesting that detail is there, that it specifically fell face downward on the ground before the ark. I had to think of, maybe somewhat unrelated, but I had to think of Philippians 2, verse 10. It says that every knee will bow. At some point, every knee will bow before Jesus. And it's pretty clear here that Dagon didn't just fall off his pedestal. He fell with his face down in front of God, in front of the ark. Now, maybe they thought, when they saw that, maybe they thought, well, maybe something really weird happened and somebody sneaked in. There was some kids came in and were playing a prank on us and set this, you know, made this thing happen. But I don't know. For one thing, I was like, well, what did they make their idols out of? So I was digging a little bit, and it's obviously thousands of years ago, so it's a little bit hard to know for sure. But from archaeology and stuff that they've dug up, it looks like they were generally made out of solid iron. We're talking a pretty heavy thing. I don't think it would have been pretty difficult for at least one person to just run in and play a prank like this. But maybe they convinced themselves that that had happened. So I love that next line. So they took Dagon and put him back in his place. Something, the first time I read that, we were reading this a while ago in devotions, and you just wanted to stop and laugh because it's, your God has to be put back in his place. Like, something that just struck me as funny. Anyway, so that night everyone goes home again, and I have to wonder if they were like, maybe we should keep someone here and just make sure this thing stays here, but maybe they were like, well, if something does go down, we don't want to be around. But I have to think there was like, man, I wonder what's going to happen. So they go home, and we know what happens next. But here's what's interesting about the next account that I had never noticed before. And it is this way in pretty much every single translation I read, I think with the exception of one, including the King James, says that, or uses the words cut off when it's talking about what happened to Dagon's head and hands. Like I said, I always thought of it as just falling over and something breaking, and that's where it landed. But if we go back to thinking about how large this temple was, and again, I don't know the setting, but it doesn't seem like there would be a door right next to it. And it specifically uses the word cut off, and I think it's pretty clear from the Hebrew word that is translated there. There's a reason they use that. It seems like what happened here is the thing falls off and something specifically cuts it off and then moves it somewhere else. And that would explain why it's on the threshold and not just this is where the thing landed. And I think there's significance behind that. It's one of those details with quite a bit of significance. What did David do to Goliath after he knocked him down with a slingshot? Yeah. And on the other, kind of the other side, we haven't gotten to this yet, but do you remember what the Philistines did to Saul after they killed him in battle? They cut off his head and went and hung it actually in another, this is actually the third time that Dagon comes up. They went and hung it in another temple of Dagon. So there was a significance to that, and it was a common practice. That's certainly not the only time where that happened. Times where that happened. It was a symbol of you're done, you're finished, this is the end of you, we are the most powerful, we've completely conquered you. If you could take someone's head, I mean that was obviously the end of them. And it was meant to prove to everyone else that would see that you don't stand up to us. This is what's going to happen to you if you try to stand up to us. So I think it's pretty significant that it uses the word cut off versus just breaking off or it happening by chance because it landed so hard. I think it was pretty clear that God was making a point that I am still the God of everything. And this is what happens when you try to stand up to me. I didn't dig real deep into what it meant to cut off the hands, too, but I think there is something significant there. I don't know the historical context for that or if that is necessarily related, but obviously cutting off a head means that there's not a whole lot they can do. But if you cut off hands as well, they really are completely powerless. There's nothing left for them to do. I'm going to read the rest of the story here. I think we're going to get down through 6:16, so it's kind of a lot of reading here, but let's just read the rest of the story. We'll make a few more comments on that. So 5:6, it says, "The hand of the Lord was heavy against the people of Ashdod, and he terrified and afflicted them with tumors, both Ashdod and its territory. And when the men of Ashdod saw how things were, they said, 'The ark of the God of Israel must not remain with us, for his hand is hard against us and against Dagon our God.' So they sent and gathered together all the lords of the Philistines and said, 'What shall we do with this ark of the God of Israel?' They answered, 'Let the ark of God of Israel be brought around to Gath.' So they brought the ark of the God of Israel there." Yeah, so that's all the way down. I think that was kind of on the southern end of where the Philistines had control of. So I don't know if the thinking there was like, let's get it as far away from the rest of the nation as we can, or exactly what the thinking was there, but they took it down there. And then, so that was verse 8. "So they brought the ark of the God of Israel there. But after they had brought it around, the hand of the Lord was against that city, causing a very great panic, and he afflicted the men of the city, both young and old, so that tumors broke out on them. So they sent the ark of God of Ekron to..." So they sent the ark of God to Ekron. "But as soon as the ark of God came to Ekron, people of Ekron cried out, 'They have brought around to us the ark of the God of Israel to kill us and our people.' They sent therefore and gathered together all the lords of the Philistines and said, 'Send away the ark of the God of Israel and let it return to its own place that it may not kill us and our people. For there is a deathly panic throughout the whole city. The hand of God was very heavy there. The men who did not die were struck with tumors, and the cry of the city went up to heaven. The ark of the Lord was in the country of the Philistines 7 months, and the Philistines called for the priests and the diviners and said, 'What shall we do with this ark of the Lord? Tell us what we shall send in to its place.'" Sorry. "Tell us with what we shall send it to its place. They said, 'If you send away the ark of the God of Israel, do not send it empty, but by all means return it with a guilt offering. Then you will be healed, and it will be known to you why this hand does not turn away from you.' And they said, 'What is the guilt offering that we should return to him?' They answered, 5 golden tumors and 5 golden mice, according to the number of the lords of the Philistines. For the same plague was on all of you and on your lords. So you must make images of your tumors and images of your mice and ravage the land and give glory to the God of Israel. Perhaps he will lighten his hand from off of you and your gods and your land. Why should you harden your hearts as the Egyptians and Pharaoh hardened their hearts after he had dealt severely with them? Did they not send the people away and they departed? Now then, take and deliver a new cart and 2 milk cows on which there has never come a yoke, and yoke the cows to the cart, but take their calves home away from them, and take the ark of the Lord and place it on the cart, and put in a box at its side the figures of gold which you are returning to him as a guilt offering. Then send it off and let it go its way, and watch, if it goes up on the way to its own land, to Beth Shemesh, then it is he who has done us this great harm. But if not, then we shall know that it is not his hand that struck us. It happened to us by coincidence. The men did so and took 2 milk cows and yoked them to their cart and shut up their calves at home. And they put the ark of the Lord on the cart and the box with the golden mice and the images of their tumors. And the cows went straight in the direction of Beth Shemesh along one highway, lowing as they went. They turned neither to the right or to the left, and the lords of the Philistines went after them as far as the border of Beth Shemesh. Now the people of Beth Shemesh were reaping their wheat harvest in the valley, and when they lifted up their eyes and saw the ark, they rejoiced to see it. The ark came into the field of Joshua of Beth Shemesh and stopped there. A great stone was there. And they split up the wood of the cart and offered the cows as a burnt offering to the Lord. And the Levites took down the ark of the Lord and the box that was beside it, in which were the golden figurines, and set them upon the great stone. And the men of Beth Shemesh offered burnt offerings and sacrifices on that day to the Lord. And when the 5 lords of the Philistines saw it, they returned that day to Ekron. Now, there's just so many juicy details in there that we could go down rabbit trails on. But, well, maybe for example, like, what exactly was this plague? What were these tumor things? And I know that the King James uses emrods, I think is the word, which I think is sort of considered like hemorrhoids, I guess. That's like would be our modern word for it. However, there's kind of a lot of debate on that because normally you don't die from that. So it seems like it was maybe something a little bit more like a plague of some kind. There's one of the fairly popular theories, I guess, is that it was something like the bubonic plague, which could produce like big tumors, especially around your lymph nodes. They would swell up really big, and it was serious. In the 1300s, you probably have heard of the bubonic plague in Europe. It killed 25 million, estimated around 25 million people. That's like 2/3 of the population of Europe. And it also would kind of could explain the whole rats, mice thing. If you remember in that was a big part of it. The rats would spread it. It actually was carried by a flea, I think it was. Yeah, I believe it was a flea, but the fleas were carried by the mice or the rats. And then as people died, that just encouraged more of these rodents. And it kind of was a self-perpetuating thing for a long time. Now, the word that's used there, offal, pretty much all the translations now would translate that as tumor, but it is a bit tricky because it can mean quite a number of different things, like mound or ulcer or boil or even just like a swelling. So it's not exactly clear exactly what that was, but it killed a bunch of them, so it was not just something that was just uncomfortable. And it doesn't really even mention the mice part of it until it gets to the part where they're talking about what to send back. So that's also kind of interesting, but obviously that was part of it too. Could have been that the mice and the rats were a separate thing from the disease or whatever this was, and it was over wheat harvest time. Well, I guess toward the end it was. Wouldn't have been the whole time. So it's possible that was just there to destroy their crops, but if it was actually part of the plague, that would be an interesting detail as well. But what I found just fascinating to think about is, why did they make it last 7 months? Like, it seems like they know right away what this thing is. Like, right from Gath, or from the first place, Ashdod, they seem to know why they're getting this disease or whatever it is. But they just sent it down to Gath, and then they sent it to the, you know, it's like traveling around. And apparently it's staying at those places quite a while, because if it lasts 7 months, like, why wouldn't we figure this out earlier than that? And I think it tells us quite a bit about who we are as humans. There's a couple of things I thought about why they chose to wait that long. And also, it was interesting, we were talking about this a little bit, and Joanna was like, when they saw what happened to Dagon, why didn't they just right away turn and be like, well, okay, I guess this is a more powerful God, maybe we should worship him. Why didn't they just do that right away? Maybe God would have honored their turning to him and not sent these plagues and stuff. And also, it was truth. I mean, if this God could be more powerful than their God, why wouldn't they want to worship that one? It would just seem to make more logical sense. But obviously, they had invested a lot into this Dagon God. And to turn to another God suddenly meant that they had been wrong this whole time. And we don't like to be wrong. We don't like to realize that everything we were living for and thought we were doing was actually completely the wrong thing. That takes a lot of humility. So I think it came down to pride, partly. And then if you know, we already looked at how kind of their whole sense of worth was based on bringing glory to this God. And if this God was actually nothing after all, then everything that they had been living for was worthless. Their life was meaningless up to that point. They didn't want to admit that. And I think third, they didn't want the truth. They chose to harden their hearts in that. I know last time we spent a lot of time looking at how we like to make gods ourselves that can bring us meaning. Instead of serving the one true God, we looked at how that possessions and money can be that, or things that we set up that give us value or think give us value, how we can make those our gods. And it's really not that much different than what they were doing here. It's maybe not represented by an idol somewhere, but the principle is the same. And yet, as Christians, we're so blessed to live in a time where the Holy Spirit, or where God lives in us. Like, we don't have to go to some temple or make a travel, you know, travel halfway across the country to a tabernacle or a temple to be able to worship God or be close to his presence. That's an incredible blessing that he lives inside us and we have become that temple. But that also brings a responsibility on us. If we look at how all the instructions that the Israelites were given on how they were supposed to treat this ark, we didn't look at it, but right after the ark comes back, some of the guys are curious and apparently look inside it, and 70 of them were killed, just like that. Like right after God comes back and makes it clear that he's coming back to his people, they disrespect it, and then they still end up, God still makes it clear that he is holy. So I don't think we should look at that as like fear necessarily, that God is going to destroy us, but we should have a reverence for the presence of God, and the fact that he's living in us and in you is, first of all, an incredible blessing, but also very humbling, and it should make us consider how we live, because it's not about we looked at this morning, we don't have to follow those rules anymore about how we come before the presence of God that were instituted with the Mosaic Law and all that. And yet, our worship is our life, is our lives. The way we live our lives is our worship. And so, the everyday things mean a lot more than just this is what we're supposed to do. Like, we're a reflection of the presence of God. And we should show him a reverence for that. Sometimes it's very clear where the personal application in a story is. I didn't quite feel that as strongly this time, especially considering what we looked at last time that goes very much with this theme. But I would maybe I'll just say this. I think if you're at a place where God is not your God and you've placed something else in that place, like, don't wait until God has to, like, knock that thing's head off. Like, just turn now, because the result could be what happens to the Philistines because of them choosing not to do that. They ended up suffering a lot and many of them dying. But I was curious if you had any input on this. Like, how do you think this does apply to us? What does this mean to you, or what jumped out to you in this story? I'll just open it up for a little bit if you have something. I don't want to keep us too much later. But what did you see in this account?
I was thinking this must have been the worst political strategy in history to ship the ark around the country, letting everyone know how weak the Israelite God, or how strong the Israelite God was and how weak Ashtaroth was. But I also, for myself personally, thought of how stubborn I am to hold on to things. I feel like I'm more like a Philistine than I'd like to be.
I think it's supposed to be an indicator of how we all are.
Yeah. So I have more of a question, I guess. I am curious why God allowed them to pick up the ark and carry it around. Because, you know, you earlier, which maybe that was just specifically to the Israelites, the Levites were the only ones that could carry it.
Yeah.
Take care of it. So was there a reason behind that, that he was actually allowed them to handle it and see? I don't know. That's something I thought of.
That is a good question, and there was specific laws. They weren't allowed to actually touch the ark. That's why there were the rings on it. I should have put a picture up, but there's rings on the side of it that poles would go through, and then you actually carried the poles. You weren't ever supposed to actually touch the ark. It's possible they did that and never actually touched it. I don't know. I think God made a promise, was it to Abraham earlier, that through the Israelites, all nations would know who he was. And in a sense, this is exactly what was happening. Like, and I like that point of, like, why did they allow it to just travel around the whole country? It doesn't go to quite all five of the major cities, but, like, everyone would have known about this thing. And so maybe that was partly why God allowed that to happen. He's like, I'm going to come right in your midst and see what happens when you choose to reject me. Like, I don't know that I can know the answer for sure to that, but I think it is amazing how God can use stuff that looks like it's done and finished, and it ends up doing the very thing that he had planned all along, which is to bring him glory. All right, anyone else? Well, we didn't really look much about how this actually affected the Israelites. Oh, sorry, did you have one? Okay.
If they indeed were aware that they shouldn't touch or carry the ark personally, it seems like it's an indicator that they still were recognizing that God was there, in there. So I'm just curious. I mean, so there's still the acknowledgement that God was, that the God of Israel was powerful enough to make them respond to not touching the ark like God had told the Israelites not to. The other thing that I thought about too was, the thing that's kind of interesting is, what happened when the ark was returned and those 70 men perished because they were looking inside to see what was there. Seemed like sometimes we kind of function like that too. We want to try to figure out the deeper things of God that he asks us just to believe by faith. And just to be obedient to what he's outlined for us and how we ought to live.
Yeah.
And that could be a huge, long discussion. I understand that.
Yeah, I think it also reminds us of how amazing it was that the curtain in the temple did rip, and yeah, we're given access in a way that we didn't.
It comes to where my mind goes is how human it is and natural for a man to try to harness God.
Yeah.
Or put him in a box. Mm-hmm. And it's a little bit what I think the children of Israel were up to when they took the ark out to battle.
Yeah.
They thought with God's presence in the ark that somehow God would bless them in battle without them having to be obedient and submissive and surrendered to his will.
Right.
And it just doesn't work. We can try the same thing in our own lives today, and we'll find similar results. Mm-hmm. And as we see the ark go around to all these heathen cities, and finally back, you know, it was not until David became king that he went and fetched the ark and brought it back to the temple. Or it wasn't a temple, but he brought it back.
Right.
But God will make his power known one way or another, you know, whether we bow to him and serve him or not. And that's kind of what I take away from this story.
Yeah, thank you. All right, well, we didn't talk much about that actually as much as maybe we could have, but about how the Israelites probably felt in this story. We looked at it a little bit. They were probably feeling like this is the end for us. But through the whole time, God was working behind the scenes, and he was making proud people humble, and he was accomplishing exactly what he wanted to accomplish. And I think it's, you know, we're not in really hard times ourselves right now, but we could at some point be in that, and there's many Christians that are. Sometimes it looks like God has deserted us, or has deserted them, but that's not the case. God doesn't desert his people, and he doesn't go back on his promises. And he's doing pretty amazing things behind the scenes. You just may not see it. So remember that.